to another edition of the Media Schwitz. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, along with Rafat Ali from Paid Content. How's it going, Rafat?
Good, good. Speaking of Paid Content, they had a conference this week that yesterday, Paid Content Mobile.
Yeah, did you check it out?
I did go for first half. It was interesting to go back into my old domain, so to speak, and catching up with former colleagues and industry people and stuff is always nice to do that.
And did you miss it at all, or?
Not really. No, not at all. I'm so happy. I'm not in the media, covering media business. I'm happy. I'm not especially in the conference, organizing conference business, because it's just so. It's like
takes a lot of effort, huh?
Sucking your own blood is essentially what it is out of yourself. It takes a lot of work. So yeah, I'm happy. I'm not part of that. But how are things with you?
Oh, everything's good. I'm getting ready to cut the cord still. Just dealing with kind of getting AT&T. I'm using an independent ISP out here. I'm not no cable company, no phone company, really. It's just Sonic.net, which is kind of an independent ISP. So we'll see. They have to still go through AT&T to get the lines put in, but a friend of mine has been using them, and he's pretty happy. He's just got a new internet-capable TV, too, which, you know, comes with everything already built in with Netflix and everything.
Inside the TV?
Yeah, Pandora. All the services are basically built into the TV. I think it's a Panasonic TV.
Interesting, yeah. Huh. So you don't even need, like, a Roku box, anything like that?
No, I mean, it might be somewhat limited. There might be a few things missing, but it sounds like almost a lot of the things that you can get just already built into the TV, you know, without even having to get that extra box. You're just plugging basically your TV right into the hub.
The only news from last week to this week is I'm moving into a new co-working space.
All right.
And
how do you think that'll impact the way you work?
Well, it will, for a start, I may work, actually. So that's one way of looking at it. I think I was sitting for the last couple of months in another office with another VC firm, but the problem that was happening was it was a satellite office for them, and there was nobody there usually during the week, very few people.
Right.
And the whole point of getting out of the house was to go among people and sit among people who are actually working so that I can get motivated to work. I could just have, if there's nobody around, I could have just sit at my apartment. So I'm giving that up. And New York, as you know, is becoming a big hotbed of startups. A lot of early, very, very early stage startups and stuff are happening. And there are a bunch of co-working spaces, General Assembly and WeWork being the two that are quite well known.
Yeah.
And General Assembly also does classes for some entrepreneurs on. Actually, I went to a class last week on startup financing and some of the finer points of it. And they're doing a 6-week course that I've actually bought. But I'm sitting in the WeWork office. I started yesterday, but I'm formally going to start next week.
Wow.
And there's just a lot of people. There are different floors and different companies. And they actually have floors for different kinds of startups. So the floor that I'm sitting on is the music floor for some reason, and which there's a lot of DJs and creative people, which creates a lot of noise. So I'm going to see if it's a good kind of noise. If it's not, then they said you can always move after another week if you want to. So I'll test it out for a week.
That's funny, because when I first went to work in an office, I had been working at home too and kind of run a virtual office for Media Shift. But at one point I was getting out of the home and trying to find a co-working space, and the space I ended up in was a lot of DJs. It was actually like a music related place. They had these great kind of parties that they threw in this space, and it was just, but it ended up being just almost impossible to be a journalist in that space, because you'd have to be on the phone trying to do interviews, and you know, there was usually music playing, and it was a very nice atmosphere to be with people, but it wasn't necessarily conducive to work. So it's tough to find that balance between having a group of people around you to support you and being able to network, but then also being able to focus, I guess.
Yeah, and at some point, I mean, I worried that then it all becomes about the scene instead of work. And there's a tendency, especially with younger first-time entrepreneurs who are in their early 20s or some even younger than that, that it turns into this whole scene instead of actual work being done. So, and I'm probably one of the older people in the co-working space. So it'd be interesting to see how that goes.
So today's show, we're going to talk about kind of a return to the IPO, tech IPOs, now that LinkedIn had their IPO today, and their shares, you know, just skyrocketed and have just been going crazy. So we'll talk about the big IPO, return of IPOs, what it means, you know, for broader IPO market. You know, is this going to be a bubble in social networking? And then we'll have a special guest, Bill Gruskin, will be joining us, who is the Dean of Academic Affairs at Columbia University's Journalism School. And he'll talk about them launching a new site called New York World, which will be kind of a local journalism site. And we'll find out, you know, what that's all about. And then finally, we'll talk about, there was just news came out that Amazon is now selling more ebooks than print books for the first time. They're not specific on the total numbers, but it is a trend that basically now might have been a tipping point for ebooks, where they're actually selling more than print books. So we'll talk a little bit about that, and also what the where the Kindle sits as far as tablets go. You know, where is it going to be? How's it going to fit into our, you know, many gadgets in our world? You know, do we need all of them? Do we need a dedicated e-reader? So we'll get to that too. But first, let's talk about LinkedIn and the big IPO today that everyone was looking forward to. The shares were priced pretty high at $45 a share, which was kind of the high end of their pricing. LinkedIn's a business network that a lot of people belong to in order to kind of do networking, hire people, you know, more of a business function. It's gotten to be a little bit more about communication, and they make money just really with by having kind of business services, but mostly it's free. They've got 90 million members. The stock shot up to over $100 a share. Right now, it's about $104 a share. So it's doubled in price, basically, and has made the founder, Reid Hoffman, a billionaire plus. If this holds out, I mean, who knows when he can exactly cash out? So I guess the question is, you know, what does it mean that LinkedIn has had such an amazing debut? You know, is it just an anomaly that there just aren't enough IPOs, or is LinkedIn really worth that much? I mean, what do you think, Rafat?
Yeah, I mean, certainly it's amazing. I'm looking at the numbers. It's $107, now 107.66 trade. It came down, of course, from its high. I think it was 120 something, above 120 today.
Yeah, 122.70, I think it's saying.
Something like that. Yeah. My guess is that it is probably the latter of what you said, which is that the market is lacking good digital IPOs and just looking forward to the big ones, the real big ones. And this is sort of the mezzanine, so to speak, or the curtain raiser for Facebook or Groupon to come.
Right.
And I mean, those are the two big ones that everybody's looking for. It does seem, I mean, it seems crazy. The valuation doubled within a couple of hours or something like that. And there are a lot of analysts who are saying that that their growth rate will have to pick up substantially in the next 5 years to justify a valuation just north of $4 billion. And they're already at, what, 8.5 or something?
Yeah. I mean, you look at the numbers and it's like, okay, they had net income of $2 million in the first quarter of this year, you know, which was up from $1.8 million a year ago. The revenues were up 110% to $93.9 million in the quarter. You know, so they've got revenues, but it's just, how do you get to, yeah, how can, you know, you can't really extrapolate to where it gets to be worth $8 billion. I mean, not a whole lot of analysts could really, you know, give any kind of real guidance on that or explanation.
Yeah.
Like, how do you explain that, right?
And also the recruitment, that's in terms of their revenues that are there right now. For the company, recruitment and services and jobs is their biggest slice of revenues, and that is a highly competitive category. I mean, not the least, the old line, big players like Career, Monster and credible than others, and then of course the other smaller sites, and then at some point you will have to, I mean, Facebook and others will play into it. There are other more focused focus industry sites and stuff that, so that is a heavily competitive category. So for to believe that that category will grow that fast seems a little unbelievable. So so that would be, and premium subscriptions, which is what you would have thought would have been a huge part, is pretty small actually. It's like 15% or something.
Yeah. How do you use LinkedIn? I mean, is that something that you're using every day? I mean, how is it? No, I don't.
I don't know about you. Do you use it?
I don't use it all that much. My experience with LinkedIn is funny because I feel like a lot of people contact me for things. I'm getting a lot of people saying, hey, do you know someone for this job? Or, hey, you know, I'm looking for this, I'm looking for that. There are all these kind of business requests that come in, and I'll usually, you know, be happy to answer them or help when I can. But I feel like a lot of times it's taking more for me than it giving me. And maybe I'm just not using it correctly, because I know other people use it all the time, use it for primary, you know, communications to people, and, you know, they're posting status updates there. You can have status updates. So, and I actually had people say things to me like, I learned about something about you that you did on Twitter because I connect my Twitter status updates to LinkedIn. And so they'll hear about things through LinkedIn because I guess they're just a little bit more active there. But in general, no, I don't use it as much. I think it's kind of untapped. Maybe it has some potential, but, you know, it seems to be, for the most part, it always feels like it's someone tugging at my sleeve asking for something.
Yeah, I get a lot of requests. I never log in, and I've turned off, I think, the email request alerting stuff, unless it's an email that somebody, in-mail, whatever they call it, in-mail that somebody sends. And once in a while, now that I'm sort of a free agent, I do get recruitment emails and stuff, and I ignore them because I'm not interested. Yeah, I just don't use it. But I think it's more the business sort of sales marketing, anybody who's in any kind of leads business, trying to get leads for stuff, sales and marketing, that kind of stuff,
right,
is use it. And we as people who either startup people or journalists and stuff don't really need it. I mean, for me, my Facebook is my LinkedIn.
Bill Kruskin is Dean of Academic Affairs at Columbia University's Journalism School. He's a longtime newspaper editor and reporter in the 80s, was a key editor at the Wall Street Journal in the 90s and 2000s, was named managing editor of Wall Street Journal Online in 2001, and deputy managing editor of news at the Journal in 2007. Welcome to the show, Bill.
Hey, guys.
How are you doing?
Hey, Bill.
This is quite an elite group we have here.
With you joining, for sure.
Talk about yourself, Bill.
How are you, Rafat?
Good, good. I haven't seen you in, what, 5 days?
I know. It's been a while. You know, I kind of miss all the pictures of Mongolia on Facebook.
I know. I miss it, too. I just want to
I mean, seriously, it was actually like the most interesting stuff on Facebook. It's so much better than reading somebody's post about how they're like dog just, you know, did something in the backyard.
Yeah. Oh, well. There's always LinkedIn, as they say.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's one more IPO I didn't get a piece of. So
that was Rafat's reaction, too.
Yeah. All right.
So tell us first about, you've got this report from last week that Rafat can maybe ask you about, but I'm curious about the New York World.
Sure.
And how that came together and what you guys are trying to do with that.
It's something we started talking about, I don't know, about a year and a half, maybe 2 years ago. We've done a lot with the curriculum here to ensure that most classes here are publishing to the web and sometimes to other platforms, and that is integrated into a lot of the teaching that we do here. The problem is that, you know, we run on an academic calendar. So the websites that the classes produce are useful educationally, but they are pretty ephemeral. And as you guys both know, an ephemeral website has a hard time building much of an audience, because once you're starting to build it, it goes dark for a period of time and you lose it. So we felt that we were making some strides on the educational part, but we were not really serving our community all that well, even though we have, you know, 250 plus students going around the streets of New York City almost every day during the academic year doing real journalism. So we decided we would try to get funding to produce a website that would be based at the school, but that would publish year-round. And that raised a couple of issues. One is obviously getting the funding for it, which thanks to Nick Lemon, the dean, and Janine Jacquet in the development office, they were able to do. They were able to get eight or nine donors to make commitments of up to 3 years to fund this. And then we are planning to staff it at its core with an editor and then six recent alumni of the Graduate School of Journalism, people who have been trained in everything from investigative journalism to digital media. And we came up with an editorial focus for it, which would be government accountability, because we live in a city with some of the highest marginal income taxes in the country, yet lots of citizens don't really have a very good sense as to how their tax dollars are being spent and how services are being dispensed around the five boroughs of New York.
So how do you think it'll differ from kind of the other sites out there? Like, you know, Gotham Gazette is really focused on kind of local government in New York, and you've got a lot of other local sites, I guess, out there.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of local sites, and what we're trying to do are two things. First of all, Gotham Gazette does some great stuff, and we look forward to talking to them. You know, keep in mind, the New York City budget alone is in the tens of billions of dollars, plus many of the decisions are being made up in Albany. So I don't think any editor would say we've got the story completely covered. There's kinds of two main things that we want to do with the site. One is we want to ensure that the journalism applies directly to how kind of services are being dispensed around New York City. So if the mayor announces that he's going to lay off 5,000 or 6,000 teachers, we want to really help citizens understand how that decision is being made, where the teachers are going to be laid off, and how they can be part of the decision being made. But beyond that, what we're hoping to do, and you know, this will bear out over the next year or so, is do outreach to other local media, many of which have had to cut back their resources in covering government and the dispensing of services by city or state government here in New York, and offer them content, whether it's stories or data sets, for them to use on their own sites. So we see it both as a site as well as something of a service. And the reason we're constructing it that way is even if we build the site up and it attains a certain audience, we think we could perform a much better service if we're also generating content that's useful to other media providers around New York City.
And it's an interesting model, getting kind of the big donor model. Is that something, I mean, are you going to try to bring in money in another way to make it sustainable on its own, or do you think it'll still be kind of donor grant driven?
We'll certainly be open to looking for other funding sources, but honestly, you know, having just spent several months working on a report on the economics of digital journalism, the way we've constructed this, it's kind of hard for me to imagine you know, doing this on a purely kind of private enterprise sort of basis. One thing that we tried to do with this was to establish a larger donor base rather than depend on a single donor. Right. And that, to make it more manageable, you know, so you're not going for just one big hit, but also to ensure that we have a number of voices involved in this.
So, Bill, this is Rafit. You mentioned a little bit about the report and stuff, and I'm curious. You said that you didn't want to set it up as a private enterprise for that. For, I guess, some of the reasons that you found out in the report. I mean, what is that? Is that a hopeful sign for industry and even for your students? that you were starting it as a, like the lessons that you learned out of that dissuaded you not to do this the private way?
Well, I think that what we felt was that in order to staff this properly, A, we want to be offered this. We want to be able to offer the paid jobs both to the editor and to the alumni who will be working on this. And that requires a certain budget, which goes into six figures, as you can probably imagine. And, you know, we are part of Columbia University, which is a nonprofit. So we're not exactly going to start getting into the angel investing game here. You know, I mean, we sort of operate in a different part of the universe.
I was just curious about, you know, what it was like making the jump from the journal to Columbia and just, you know, what some of the challenges are. I know Columbia has gone through a lot of kind of soul searching on, you know, how it deals with teaching in the digital age and how things have changed so much. How have things gone in that regard? Was that a challenge when you first got there?
What I would say is that the challenges that we face here at Columbia are not that different in some ways from the challenges being faced by a lot of traditional media organizations that are looking to retool themselves in a digital age.
But they might even move a little slower in academia.
Yeah, actually, I would say that we're able to move a little bit more quickly here, you know, based on my experience outside and kind of what I've seen going on in the industry, because first of all, we have a faculty that's very devoted to journalism and a number of hires. You all know about Emily Bell here and Doolin, too. And we just made another hire for the Tau Center for Digital Journalism that we'll be announcing in a few days. But this is someone who's a programmer. She's a senior programmer at a major website who will be teaching and helping in the curriculum. We also have access to what I have to say is the best adjunct pool in the world here in New York City. And so we've been able to really do a lot of very creative things with the curriculum, whether it's an interactive design class taught by a couple of the top designers at NewYorkTimes.com, or bringing in people in photo and video and that kind of thing. But I think the biggest challenge we face at Columbia is that we are a one-year program, and there's a lot to teach students, because we want to ensure that the digital training is infused with core journalistic training that you two know very well, which is, you know, how do you interview people? How do you create a compelling narrative? How do you authenticate information? And we think those things are as valuable as they ever were.
So, Bill, I had a sort of a – I don't know if it's a related question, but in somewhat, I was kind of curious about why – and you may have answered it in some part – but why doesn't Columbia have sort of entrepreneurship classes, or – I mean, I guess they're done through the business school, but – like more of sort of what some of the other schools are doing in terms of like letting people actually start businesses and then fund it. Why aren't you in the business of that?
So here's what we've done on that level. a couple of years ago, we started a course which I actually teach. It's a mandated course for every MS student, every full-time MS student, called The Business of Journalism. And that is a core course which takes students through the legacy business models for print and broadcast. It helps them understand how digital has fundamentally and irrevocably disrupted those models, and then challenges them at the end to come up with new business models, either for new companies or for existing companies, that would help us get over some of the challenges that are being faced right now. In addition to that, we started a couple of new courses in the spring semester. One is called Making the Business of Journalism Work, taught by my co-author Ava C. from the business school, that takes students much more deeply into understanding what are the elements that go into a digital business. And Emily Bell co-taught a course also in the spring called Costs and Effect, which was a really powerful course that helps students understand that. In addition to that, over the fall, we have a number of sessions with Ken Lehrer, who was the former CEO of the Huffington Post.
Are students, what's their reaction to all this? Because I've been at schools where the students actually were resistant to doing the more digital kinds of things and thought, you know, I want to come here and I want to be in print or I want to be in, like, they actually had almost a traditional mindset too. Have you found that at
There's
Columbia?
certainly, I mean, look at, there are a lot of students who come here who major in what we call the magazine concentration, which is kind of a euphemism for more long form journalism, because Columbia's had a long and very proud reputation for doing that well. We still think that there's going to be a lot of new avenues for long form journalism. One of the things that we did this year, we've always had a couple of workshops in the spring called the Magazine Workshop. One of them this year was a pure online magazine. So it didn't produce any kind of a print product, but the students built and populated the site on their own because, as we've seen from everything from a Slate to an atavist, there are a lot of really interesting things going on with digital presentation of long-form journalism.
No question. So you feel like the students are kind of coming around to it?
Well, I think it's kind of there's kind of a bell curve distribution, from the students who come here kind of already pretty fully digitized, the students who are just starting to set up their first Twitter account. That is the way the world is. I think if you went to most newsrooms, you would see something like that too.
Well, thanks for joining us. I know you got to jump, got a meeting, but we
Yeah.
appreciate you coming on and talking about all this.
Absolutely.
So, what's your take on Columbia? What's your what's been your experience there?
Well,
Because it
I mean, the
sounds like
reason I
you've
asked, I had some history there. And because I know Jeff Jarvis very well, and I know the CUNY stuff very well.
Yeah, and I'm curious about how, like, CUNY. I feel like there's a lot going on there with CUNY and NYU and Columbia all kind of really trying to really compete when it comes to
Yeah,
digital
and all
things.
have sort of superstars, of course, in the journalism field, and Emily and Bill and others in the Columbia, Jeff and Steve Shepard and others there, CUNY and NYU, of course, Jay Rose and
But
Cambridge.
I mean, what do you, yeah, so they've all have some great staff. They're really pushing. Do you see, like, is there a general, I mean, CUNY is trying to say that it's more the entrepreneurial.
Yeah, I think they've sort of
Columbia's
taken
got the
it down to
tradition.
brass tacks, like, really, okay, let's start a business. That's it. How do we create a content/content services business? And whether it's if journalism is in there, that's great, but journalism is incidental, or at least just one small part of what they're trying to teach, it seems like. That's what my guess is.
Right.
And Columbia, more traditional stuff. I think they're still sort of more leaning towards bigger media companies.
So let's just last item is to talk about Amazon passing this kind of threshold where they're selling more ebooks than print books. According to Amazon, since April 1st, they've sold 105 ebooks for every 100 print books. And now their ad-supported Kindle, which sells for $114, is now the top-selling e-reader. So Amazon seems like they're doing pretty well. What do you read into this news as far as ebooks passing print books? Is this just going to keep getting more and more that way?
It seems so. I mean, there was print. The books industry has been the fastest industry to go digital. They were the last industry in the media, sort of larger media field,
Right.
to go digital. But they've been the fastest industry to go digital, and it just seems. I mean, nobody would have believed this point would have come. I mean, 5 years ago, we wouldn't have thought this would have happened. So.
Right, the Kindle was only released 4 years
Kindle
ago,
was 4 years
so.
ago, so but just the use case and has been proved so beyond doubt that I think this is what this shows, and the price has come down a lot. I think Kindle, to their credit, what they've done is sort of kept their head down. Yes, there's a lot of talk about Apple and iPad and other tablets and stuff, and how they would completely kill Kindle, but Kindle just sort of, okay, does one thing and does one thing very well, which is downloads book fast and read. and cheap relatively, most of them.
Right, and it's like, what's the lesson from, you know, flip cam, where it was just, okay, it was just a video camera, that's all it did, and it was, you know, that made a lot of sense, and now you can do video shooting with your phone, so we don't need the flip cam anymore, at least according to Cisco. But it seems like this is kind of one function device. There's still a market for it if it's priced cheap enough, if it's easy to use. You know, why not have that?
Yeah, and also, I mean, a little different than Flip, because Amazon also has a lock on those relationships with the publishers, and they can sort of muscle that, and they have.
Right.
They've not shied away from that. Even the publishers have tried to get the prices up and stuff like that, but for most of the books, it's still below $9.99 or $9, something like that. So,
right.
And also they've innovated in a lot of stuff. I mean, they haven't come to touchscreen and stuff, but I think their rationale has been that it will drain the battery longer and people don't need it or something like that. I mean, the Nook. What do you use? Do you use Kindle or Nook?
I had the Kindle 2 and used that for about a year, and I haven't played around with the Nook yet. But I've been seeing a lot about this Color Nook that came out that really tried to add in a little bit more functionality, you know, and you could read your email and you could do a lot more than you could with the Kindle. I mean, I really enjoyed using the Kindle. It became kind of my primary reader for news. I was getting San Francisco Chronicle on it. And it's just light, simple, easy, you know, much more portable. But I have to say, you know, once I got the iPad, the Kindle just started gathering dust, because all of the reading on the iPad to me is a lot nicer, really.
No, it hasn't. I mean, for me, Kindle is more books, and iPad is more Twitter, Facebook, and magazine, and some of the apps that are there.
Right.
So that's how I have sort of demarcated it that way. And I also have a policy of not taking anything digital in my bedroom except, I guess, Kindle, but that I don't consider that digital device.
It's just like the continuum of how digital something is, and how, well, it's not, I guess it's not online as much. You're downloading books, but you're not necessarily checking your email. It's not as much of a work device, right?
It's not, and I think that's I call it the peaceful device, because it's just peaceful.
Thanks for joining us for another edition of the Media Schwitz. I'm Mark Glazer, along with Rafat Ali. We want to thank our guest, Bill Gruskin from Columbia University's Journalism School, as well as PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to follow us for all the news, polls, and events over at PBS MediaShift at pbs.org/MediaShift and our sister blog, IdeaLab, at pbs.org/IdeaLab. We'll catch you next week.
Time.